My name's Heiko Kuh. I've been running a radio show since 2003, well, until earlier this year when, because of apparently due to Ofcom complaints and me standing in the election, the radio show was suspended and hasn't been reinstated until yet, till now. But basically, what I've been doing is speaking at Speaker's Corner and monitoring and reporting and recording the sounds and thoughts and activities of people at Speaker's Corner who discuss all types of things, from religion to politics to philosophy to sex to, you know, everything under the sun, basically.
Was it actually called the Speaker's Corner programme in any way? It's just very important that this is recorded, and it's lovely, the whole concept of the idea that, you know, free speech in Hyde Park is broadcast over the city.
Well, an important element of this dynamic is that since the coronavirus restrictions became more and more ubiquitous and petty, it became a policy of YouTube, aka Google, to censor what was being said at Speaker's Corner. And the way they did that was simply deleting speeches which had been made in Hyde Park or recordings from Hyde Park on spurious grounds, citing WHO ideas or information, local government authorities' information or decisions. And one of the grounds for suspending my account from YouTube was views which disagree with the consensus, which of course is in direct contradiction to the very idea of Speaker's Corner. I said to them, so are you going to just censor live streams from Speaker's Corner? And they said, well, there's no exemption for Speaker's Corner. So in other words, yes, live streams are censored by YouTube, Google. And of course, because Ofcom complaints, radio shows that broadcast such views as might be considered offensive by certain people can also now be, or are also, censored. And I don't blame the radio station taking my show off air temporarily. I know they're under a lot of pressure and they were worried about it, and so I don't blame them per se, but it's indicative that a radio station that is very open and willing to broadcast views, music, sounds, ideas, culture that might be a little out of the box, might not be, but it might be a little out of the box, that they felt that they were no longer able to do so.
The stuff you used to do, Heiko, I don't think I'd ever heard anywhere else, really, which was, you know, some recordings as live recordings from Speaker's Corner. So you were able to sort of pick up things like interactions with between the police and speakers there. One I particularly remember was where the idea that if you're stationary, it can be a problem, but if you're moving around, it's okay. And so I think it was you or somebody else anyway, decided that they were going to get on a bicycle at Speaker's Corner and go round and round and speak like that, you know, really showing the absurdity of the, and there's nobody, it seems to me, satirizing and making fun of some of these appalling, well, they're not appalling, they are absurd rules, some of them.
Dictatorial power is generally undermined by ridicule and absurdity, because it is absurd, and historically that's been the case. You know, there's an armory of jokes from the Soviet Union and from Nazi Germany that were all concerned with the bizarre, the peculiar, the odd, if you like, making the powers that be seem like that, seem bizarre, seem stupid, seem foolish, seem idiotic. And it's part of the course of, in fact, in Britain, you know, a lot of this Monty Python stuff and all that was based upon that as well, wasn't it? You know, a bureaucrat, an official somebody tries to be somebody big. And the British grit got them down, you know, that, and a lot of the films in Britain after the Second World War were based on that as well, you know. British humour survives, you know. We can make fun out of the Tom, out of the Jerrys when they've got no sense of humour, you know. So it's very much in the British tradition.
Yes, yeah, pity. And I feel a certain affinity to you, you know, because I've had my radio show in Bristol banned due to Ofcom rules, according to our manager, they said temporarily. And then they just simply refused to reinstate it, in fact, even to communicate with me again. But anyhow, look, one of the things that's been going on in London, which I think is fascinating, is the, and we keep hearing about it in other parts of the country, has been these Extinction Rebellion stroke Insulate Britain characters turning up on the M25 to shut the M25 down. Now, I mean, you can see from a certain point of view, they want to get publicity, but there seems to be a sort of a strange element here of targeting with your direct action the very people that you're trying to bring on side. So you're trying to create a wave of public opinion, which is, in this case, Insulating Britain. Obviously, Extinction Rebellion have got many aspects, but it doesn't seem to make sense to me, and maybe you can help explain, to go and actually inconvenience, you know, to leave the big banks, the big companies, headquarters, the shareholders, the AGMs, etc., alone, but and to go for the general public, who largely don't have much choice about whether they're sitting in a car going backwards and forwards to work or not.
I think there's a combo here. On the one side, from a theoretical point of view, this guy, Roger Hallam, who was one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, his PhD is based around how you tip the balance in a debate, a political debate, and it, like in society, and how you should create a paradigm shift. And his theory, based on some observations of some protests around the world and his selection of data associated with them, argues that if you have a determined group of people who are prepared to go to be incarcerated or to be arrested or, you know, you go to jail or be arrested temporarily, and are prepared to take a militant enough action to compel the police to arrest you, then either the police will back off arresting, in which case you've achieved some victory, or the police will arrest, and then if you've got enough people committed to being arrested, then, you know, it can fill up the whole legal processes, and they, you know how many police cells they've got, how many available staff they've got, and so on. So you can clog up the system. And then in terms of strategic targets, if you can pick targets that have maximum impact with minimum numbers, so if one person can block a road or five people can block a road by gluing themselves to the floor, and you know that the road is a major artery for the maintenance of the economy and society, then, you know, then you've got a strategic weak point, haven't you? And so that's the theory he's got. So his theory is that if you've got 3% of the population on your side, then eventually you'll win a majority. So now, of course, the question begs itself, well, does that mean anyone who wants to get 3% could do whatever they like to try and get attention? And that's basically what they do. And during the first wave of Extinction Rebellion protests, there were people who went to the meetings and they were basically asked to fill out a piece of paper. And it says, are you prepared to be arrested? Are you prepared to go to prison? Tick here, tick there. Were you prepared to volunteer? And so it was basically this structure. And he tried to create a network of primarily middle class people sympathetic to the Greens who lack perhaps a mission in their life and the salvation of humanity from bad weather, or better said, long-term bad weather impacts of whether it be natural or man-made. The idea is that it's man-made. That by creating this network that appeals to this layer of the population, that you could create a movement, and they certainly have done that. Whether it's a genuine, organic grassroots movement is another question. they certainly have very big supporters. And it seems to me it's a pincer operation. On the one side, you have the sort of appearance of a grassroots movement, although definitely the numbers have declined dramatically who are participating in this movement compared with the first year or like just the year before the pandemic, in inverted commas. But at the same time, to have a layer within the institutions of the state and corporate and the biggest corporations in the world who declare their sympathies with these protests. So I may not like the method they use, but I'm fully sympathetic with everything they do. And so you cover every angle. You've got, you know, the person who blocks, sticks themselves to the floor or climbs a tree and hangs from it and or you know, risk their life to block whatever X, Y, and Z. That's the grassroots protest level, or the school students who go on strike thinking the climate's worse than ever before. And on the other side, people like Paul Polman, the former CEO of Unilever, one of the largest corporations in the world, or used to be one of the largest corporations in the world, and Mark Carney, the former head of the Bank of England. Now the Queen has expressed her indignation at the irritation at the lack of progress, whatever that means. Again, aligning herself, and she's hardly the person to sit down in a road sticking herself with glue, aligning herself with people who are doing that. So it's that combination of trying to present a united front of everyone who's concerned about the world, using all means possible, government meetings like COP26 and street protests that blockade roads. And eventually the press will cover it. Well, if there's ever been a story that's been saturated coverage in the press, other than coronavirus, it's climate change. Climate change has to be the number one story in the press everywhere in the world, or almost everywhere in the world, and without really any justification. Literally, you know, you can literally have a couple of days of bad weather and it will be attributed to climate change. If it gets cold, we're told it's caused by climate change. If it gets warm, we're told it's caused by climate change. If there's no wind, we're told it's caused by climate change. If it's very windy, we're told it's caused by climate change. So it's a catch-all, and it's catching all in terms of, you know, you just observe today's weather. I mean, it's very unusual for this time of the day to have this type of weather. And, you know, I'm sure it'll be the same all day long and all year long and forever onwards. But it covers everybody. So you cover all the protests and you cover all the climatic conditions. So it's the perfect catch-all for everything.
So what's the purpose? Take a step back from the whole Extinction Rebellion climate debate, very much being talked about. We've got the Glasgow conference just coming up, as you say, the COP26. Looks as if quite unlikely that the Russian and Chinese leaders will be going along to that, though. What? Take a step back from it. What is going on?
Global capitalism is in crisis. It has been in deep crisis, certainly since 2008, 2009. It never really escaped from that crisis, returning to growth rates from before that period or profit rates from before that period. But then there was nevertheless a realignment of capitalist interests, focusing primarily on technology and big pharma. But aligned with that is essentially a section of the economy, finance, big pharma, big tech, who would like to reset and restructure the economy around their pet projects. And their pet projects all require vast amounts of capital to be invested. And in order to invest those things, the capitalists themselves, the big enterprises, Apple, Google, and so on, don't really want to just spend their own money on vanity projects that might go nowhere. And so they rely upon governments to finance them. And because China is a government-led investment state and has its own indigenous technologies as well as those it's reshaped from Western technologies, it's seen as a major competitor to US imperialism and the European capitalists, which are the largest capitalists in the world. capitalist powers in the world, and Japan, obviously. And so the Western entities, large corporations, the big tech companies and the big pharma and the big financial companies, they have tried to twist the arm of governments behind their back to get them to throw money at mission-based projects, so not profit-based projects. Profit-based project, any little company wants to run a coffee shop or market stall or something, they have to make a profit, right? But these companies, they're so huge. On the one side, you have the no big to fail example. So we know that from 2008, that you can't let the banks go bankrupt. Everything must be done to save them. And now in 2020-21, we had a big pharma is necessary in order to save the world. And now in 2021, it's been ongoing, you've got the giant technology solutions to climate problems or so-called climate problems being pumped. And you have to create a mood in society which will unlock the resources stored up in pension funds and in, you know, in bank projects that are supposed to be for-profit projects. These must be released in order to be invested in new technologies whose efficacy is practically zero. But I mean, even for the objectives they want, which in my opinion are totally useless in any case, but even to meet their own objectives, these measures will not achieve them. But what they will do is put huge quantities of capital at the disposal of the companies that are coming with the solutions, you know, put their hands up. We can do this. We can take carbon from the air. We can change the weather. We can seed the clouds. We can insulate all the houses. We can provide heat pumps to every house. Well, if you're going to provide heat pumps at £5,000 a head to every household in Britain, how many resources are going to be extracted from the earth in order to produce them? If you're going to produce these carbon capture devices, how many machines are they going to have to produce to do this? And it's most easily exposed in Europe, where Germany is one of the most historically one of the most green countries in the world. Well, Volkswagen was shown to be fraudulently manipulating the data on their emissions of their cars. I don't know how many they had to withdraw, 1 million or 2 million cars, something like that. And on the other side, you've got this biomass industry. So you basically, you grow rapidly growing trees that don't capture hardly any carbon, chop them down, because it's called carbon offset to plant a tree. And then you make pellets out of them and burn the pellets. And the pellets have got an efficiency for fuel of nothing. I mean, compared with coal, it's totally useless. And yet this is ongoing. And I think it constitutes now 60% of the electricity production in Germany, as far as I'm concerned, something like that. Anyways, so it's a bizarre combination of white elephant projects to be funded by the state to try and in the name of protecting the environment, in actual fact, in order to strengthen Western capitalist enterprises vis-a-vis China. That's the real objective behind it, in my opinion.
Well, you're almost saying there that coal is something. I mean, I find it's something a little bit unsettling about the absolutely this idea that, you know, coal is completely not to be used. I'm old enough to remember the 1970s and the 1980s, when we had an enormous great battle in Britain with the National Union of Mine Workers. And that at the time, you know, the vast majority of the left and the population, many of the population who relied on coal, were on the side of the miners, against the Thatcher government. And now it seems that the tables have turned, that coal, after all, it was good to get rid of the coal mines in Britain and to start importing coal. What are your thoughts about whether coal is actually as bad as it's we're told it is?
Yeah, I mean, it's good that you reminded me of that. You know, this is unfortunately the degeneration of the so-called left the Labour Party and the socialists in Britain, but also around the world, as they've adopted this narrative of the big technology companies that they are the saviors of humanity, as if using a mobile phone or buying bitcoins or using a computer is somehow green. I mean, it's preposterous. I was looking around my house today, how many machines and equipment and so on, and I haven't got a lot of these things, but how many of these things have you got stuck in your house now? And how many of them do you throw away when you want to get a new one? And how many resources? You know, they've all got huge amounts of plastic and electronics and rare earth metals and so on. So it's the plunder of the earth in the name of saving the earth. That's the game, because none of the proposals they are making will ever be able to bring down carbon emissions to zero, or even probably to net zero. But net zero is such a con anyway that it's ridiculous. But yes, the miners were being supported. And Arthur Scargill correctly used to say, we have the cheapest deep mine coal in the world. The only reason it was more expensive than other countries was because we were paying the pensions of people who had become ill or were dying, who had been working in the mines. You know, and they had a lot of miners in the past. And so there were a lot of people who were on pensions. And you took away the pensions from the costs of deep mine, or from the cost of the coal mining industry in Britain, and coal was efficient. And in China, they continue producing coal. And of course, gas is essential, because without wind, you know, about a week and a half ago, there was a report on the BBC saying that there's not enough wind in Britain to make the wind farms work properly. And wind has gone down by 20%. And then they had some idiotic modelers who started with the fact wind gone down 20%. Because they couldn't provide the electricity without firing up the gas power stations that are backups for the wind when it dies down. And they said the reason why the wind has gone down is because of climate change. I mean, you can't make it up.
Well, we've got a big event going on London on Monday, and that is the switch on of the ULEZ, the extension of it out to the North and South Circular Roads. Yeah. I mean, I'm reminded of what you just said about this sort of, you know, people buying stuff, because there are roughly 100,000 cars and vans within that area used by individuals and largely by small businesses that will suddenly have to pay £15 extra a day as soon as they basically move within that area. And this, there is one get out clause for people, of course, and that is that if they buy a brand new vehicle, that they won't have to pay that charge. Now, it does seem as if something a bit peculiar is going on there too. We're being told this is something to save the environment, save the planet, and yet there is a massive incentive now on those people to buy a brand new car.
That's right. And they're offered huge subsidies to do so. A friend of mine works in the building industry. He had a van that was 2 years old. And these vans, you know, a diesel van with, you know, it'll go for 200,000 miles if you look after it without any problem. And he'd only just bought it a couple of years before. And then he got £7,000 from the government for London to scrap his old vehicle and buy a new one, which would be ULEZ compliant. And so this again is a mechanism by which the technology companies, in conjunction with auto enterprises, get a massive subsidy to boost their investments in creating this infrastructure. And of course, the whole thing requires a certain infrastructure. And unless you have a sufficient scale of infrastructure, then you could never take off with these projects. And so you have these speculative investments in companies like Tesla. I looked at the figures yesterday for Tesla. I think it was 426 times price earnings ratio, the value of the company. So here you have a purely speculative model of a company based on hype around what they're going to be able to do in the future. You'd be far better off, in my opinion, doing research. You see, their argument is that you need this competition between lots of companies in order to drive forward the innovation. And if, like, one project making these batteries and turns out to be rubbish, well, so be it. And if another project turns out, in the end, you'll have the best player in the marketplace will dominate the market, or the best three or four players will dominate the market and have hyper-efficient battery systems and so on. Or you might be better off just waiting 20 years, and developing the systems, first of all, before you go throwing resources at things that are going to be thrown away in a couple of years' time anyway, and will cost the Earth enormous amount of resources, which you can only secure by plundering the oceans, the bottom of the ocean, of the rare earth metals which exist there. And that's the current part of the current projects they've got now, is basically to plunder the seas. And so the idea is you commodify everything, and then you make these commodities everywhere in the world. The ocean becomes a commodity, the seabed becomes a commodity, all animal and plant life become commodities, because all of them might turn up with something useful one day when you know the DNA, the way they work, the RNA and all the rest of it. And so it's about a sort of conquest of potential, or theoretically potential, marketplaces, and the delusion that man can control everything, can control the climate. And that man, you see, the starting point is, if we want to become God, we imagine that we are already God. So we are already shaping the weather of the planet. That's the theory. So we are God, and therefore we must play the role of God and stop changing the planet. And we haven't figured out the ways to do that yet, but we've got lots of schemes, you know, lots of ways to emulate God. And that's what they're basically doing, you know. And no wonder these people, individuals who control these companies, think they have to go up to space and see God. You know, there was a joke in the Soviet Union. Yuri Gagarin came back. He was the first man in space. And he came back from space and he visited Brezhnev. Khrushchev. And Khrushchev calls him into a room in the Kremlin, and he says, ask everyone else to leave the room. And then he says, Yuri, when you got to heaven, or when you went to space, did you see God? And Gagarin says, yes. And Khrushchev goes, I thought so. He goes, not a word to anybody, or you'll never see your family again. And then, Gagarin travels the world, and he goes to many different countries. He ends up visiting the Pope in Rome, and he has a private audience with the Pope, and he shoos all his advisors away, and he says, Yuri, when you got to heaven, did you see God? He says, no. And the Pope says, oh, I thought so. Not a word to anybody, or you'll be condemned for life. So, you know, they think they're God. That's what Elon Musk appeared. They think they're God.
Now, down at Speaker's Corner, there will also, I'm sure, be some sort of discussion about the reintroduction of the Coronavirus Act for another 6 months. This was discussed in Parliament a little bit. The MP that died last Friday, Sir David Amess, would have been one of the speakers, almost certainly, maybe even the lead speaker in that debate. But then there was decided to nod it through without a vote.
Is that right? Yeah. We're in a world of total lunacy, where, I mean, I keep being pulled up by people, because I'm of the view that new lockdowns are not coming, at least not for now. I think they'll overplay their hand if they try and lock down again. But I've been wrong before. You know, lots of people tell me no, they're going to do it, and today's news looks like that sort of story from the Nudge Unit, you know, where you've got, you know, NHS, some bod from the NHS who I've never heard of before, he's never been prominent in the news before, suddenly gets front page coverage saying that we need immediate lockdowns, otherwise, you know, and for what reason? Who knows what the reason's supposed to be? Because the NHS has got 5 million people in a waiting list. Well, that's a reason not to lock down, as far as I can see. Just get on with treating people instead of pretending everything's about who's got a runny nose. You know, I mean, and even if you've got a runny nose, nobody knows what you've got. Because when they do these tests, let's say you do 300,000 tests a day of people who think they've got some symptom. It's got to be at least that. Of them, you're turning up with 30,000 to 40,000 so-called cases of people who are said to have coronavirus. So let's assume all that's perfectly true. Well, what have the other 270,000 people got? They're all saying they've got some symptoms. What have they got? Where's the test for what they've got? And how many of them die within 28 days of a of a negative test. And I don't think that's ever been asked, how many people die within 28 days of a negative test. Any case,
isn't it a bit flippant of you, though, to talk about this as a runny nose? I mean, that is surely, you know, there is something much more complicated going on with COVID that is basically SARS, and it causes this lack of oxygen and a cytokine storm, which appears to look a bit like pneumonia. And, you know, tens of thousands of people have died with this, Heiko.
Yeah, but tens of thousands of people die every year of various types of pneumonia. Pneumonia is probably one of the number one killers in the world. SARS, and I've done a lot of research on this, never went away. This is the great lie. The big lie is that this is something new, whereas SARS, it's been shown by Zhong Nanshan, the lead epidemiologist in China, the guy who ran the campaign in 2002, ran the campaign in 2020. He's seen as the Yuri Gagarin of China. And his study in 2013 showed that 20% of children in Guangzhou had antibodies to SARS, born after 2005, so 2 years after SARS disappeared, or a year and a half after SARS apparently disappeared. And the samples were taken in 2010 to 2012. So SARS has been around all along. It's mutated in various forms. And any time you get coronaviruses, one or more coronavirus in your body, then you can create either a new virus or a significant mutation to that virus. And so what I'm saying is, the reason I say runny nose is because most people who get SARS-CoV-2 infection, in other words, it enters the body and multiplies but does not cause disease, literally just get a runny nose, and most of them don't have any symptoms at all. A small minority of people come down with quite significant symptoms, some of which are, even in young people, can be worse than what you would normally get as a cold. Although just recently there have been reports that people who've been specifically excluded from having a cold, who are young, have said they've had the worst cold recently that they've ever had in their life. And that was attributed on the BBC website to the lack of contact between people, which creates the foundation for stronger virulence or stronger power for cold viruses and flu viruses of various sorts. So the point is that there are people with symptoms of severe illness or bad illness, which are flu-like or cold-like, which have other causes than SARS. And we know that's the case because the records of the government themselves say that. If you've got 300,000 people declaring they've got some symptom, as I said, you'd have to know how many of them died within 28 days of a negative test, because then you'd have some idea about what else is going around. And we don't test for what else people have. And therefore, we do not know how many of those people who have a disease attributed to SARS have got SARS. We simply don't know it. We don't know, or better said, we don't know whether SARS is the causative agent creating their illness, or is the main agent creating their illness. Because, for example, there was a study from Glasgow University published in 2020, but it finished in 2019. It was a survey of respiratory illnesses in Glasgow throughout the period from about 2000, over more than a decade. And these viruses come around every winter, and coronaviruses constitute about 7 to 15% of these illnesses every single year, and they always have done. And so if we're not testing for the other coronaviruses, and we're not testing for other agents that can cause exactly the same thing, it is impossible to say whether people are actually dying of SARS-CoV-2 infections provoking COVID-19, or whether they're dying of something else. It's impossible to say that, unless you carry autopsies. If you carry autopsies and you can find directly that that's the causative agent, then that's fine. But the only person who's done that is Klaus Puschel in Hamburg. And he said that even though SARS was the causative agent for the deaths of many people, he said that all the people he had studied were in such a moribund state who had died, whose bodies were in such a moribund state that any agent would have killed them. He's the only person who's carried out systematic autopsies of all bodies that were in Hamburg that died from or with coronavirus.
Well, look, Sky News Australia last week has come out with a documentary, What Really Happened in Wuhan. They have interviewed various people, including Mike Pompeo and the former boss of MI6, Richard Dearlove. It's taken a year to make it, and they are absolutely adamant that what came out of Wuhan was from a lab-made virus, and that the Chinese just did everything they possibly could to cover it up. Now, just to sort of caveat that, there was no real analysis and understanding in the documentary of the amazing coincidence of having this World Military Games in Wuhan in October 2019, which then, you know, miraculously spread whatever it is that kind of flew out of the chimney of Wuhan lab all around the world. So that was a bit of a coincidence. And also, they didn't really explain the presence of the Pentagon-funded EcoHealth Alliance and Dr. Peter Daszak, who's actually a Brit, who was one of the people down in Wuhan manufacturing these gain-of-function, you know, banned, basically gain-of-function viruses designed to try to take powerful human viruses, which can, are very contagious, and then juice them up, you might say, by putting some kind of very nasty spike protein on, or protein onto this very contagious virus. So, anyway, what do you make of this Australian documentary, which really does seem to point the finger at the Chinese in Wuhan as creating this and then spreading it around the world and trying to cover it up?
I recently read the study by there's one Chinese woman who was supposedly the whistleblower who revealed all about the lab production of this virus and says this could not have happened had it not been a manufactured product. And she argues that based on the idea, and she leaves that space open, although tries to conceal it, and I will write a systematic reply to this quite shortly. She argues it based on the idea this couldn't possibly be existent in nature because we haven't found it in nature. We haven't looked in nature. We haven't looked. And so because of that, and because of the hysteria that emerged, and this is the biggest joke of all, in my opinion, I think the entire Wuhan lab theory is a conspiracy theory. And a conspiracy theory promoted by the leading figures internationally in the United States and so on, as part of their war against China. They know it to be factually incorrect because they know this paper published by Zhong Nanshan on Cornell University website in 2013 shows that SARS never went away. So you can look all across the internet. The starting point is this. Did SARS go away? If SARS went away, as the WHO says, as the American CDC says, as the British state says, and the British Medical Service, as the BMA says, as all you look in all the medical journals around the world, and you will see all of them say SARS disappeared in 2003 or 2004. And there were no cases of SARS since that time. That's the argument. That's because without that argument, you don't have an origin theory in Wuhan in 2019. If SARS never went away, and has been in general circulation around the world at a high or low intensity level, then the argument simply disappears. Now, what I'm arguing is that this is rooted in a false theoretical framework, again, promoted by big data. And this theory is that we can identify, or better said, when we identify a virus and claim it's a causative agent, that is the date when it appears, or shortly before that. So, for example, if a couple of people drop down dead in Wuhan and a doctor gets scared and lots of patients get a rumor, because China is a rumor-monger country because of the way in which the regime exists, the way in which it operates, it naturally produces significant rumors because people don't trust the government to tell the truth to them rapidly and efficiently. Not that they do here, but it's a different method here. And so the consequence of that is the government rapidly locked down, thinking it might be some new strain of SARS, which is deadly, and therefore that might cause some problem. In actual fact, SARS was not deadly the first time round. It appeared to be deadly because the numbers of people detected who had it was 8,000 something or other, and 10% of them died. In actual fact, SARS circulated, took millions and millions and millions of people, and only 800 people died. In other words, it was not a deadly illness, but it still maintained across the world that this was a deadly, deadly, deadly illness. Now, how can 20% of children in Guangzhou have antibodies to SARS in 2010 to 12 unless it was circulating generally within the population? In Beijing hospitals, they tested and they showed that 40% of children in 2001, before SARS existed, had SARS antibodies. So there is a way of testing this all. And it's very, very simple. You go to the samples, blood samples stored in Europe, America, China, and elsewhere, and you look, you test the blood samples that have been stored at the right temperature, and you see, do they have cross-reactivity? Do they have antibodies or cross-reactivity to the SARS virus? Do they have the SARS viruses present or SARS viruses present? And it's my guess, and just one more point. Well, my guess is, and this is verifiable, you'll find a prevalence rate of 2 to 5% right across the board throughout the last 20 years. And in fact, probably going back the last 100 years.
Now, here in the West Country, in Gloucester Cathedral, there's a statue of Edward Jenner. He's the inventor of vaccines with cowpox and smallpox, did some rather what we would now call totally unethical experiments on people, including children, in order to infect them with cowpox. But he did successfully help eradicate smallpox. If you look at what he was doing there, it does seem like a milder version of the coronavirus is something like the common cold coronavirus or the rhinovirus. And the BBC and others have reported very clearly that these mild forms, that like the rhinovirus, actually kick SARS-CoV-2 out of your system. So even if it's starting to establish itself, an early treatment with a basic common cold can immunize you almost immediately against SARS-CoV-2, and yet this has just simply not been done. And it seems that's just one of many treatments that the National Health Service, the Department for Health, the government, and the media have simply ignored.
Yeah, there's a study done in China in 2013. It's titled, it's in BMC Infectious Diseases, it's published in, and it says, first infection by all four non-severe acute respiratory syndrome human coronaviruses takes place during childhood. They found that 100% of the samples tested in Beijing at the time of children under 15 had antibodies to all four, or had been infected at some stage or other with all four common coronaviruses. Now, that's without looking for others. Yeah, if you're only looking for the four, there are other coronaviruses we don't even know about. What we're not told, and was often, you know, people just are unaware what coronaviruses are, what the meaning of them is, and so on, and what and how prevalent they are. NL63 is a coronavirus, an alpha coronavirus, that is said to come from, wait for it, bats and palm civets. It was first discovered in Netherlands in 2004 in a young child. If you look at the surveys from the United States of America, the surveillance in the United States of America of the causative agents of respiratory illnesses in old people and young people in the United States from 2015 to 19, you'll find that NL63 accounts for between 2 and 5% of all respiratory illness infections with coronaviruses. Now, that tells you again, why have we not been looking at NL63, which is a bat civet transmitted, supposedly bat civet transmitted virus? And that's questionable anyway, but supposedly bat civet transmitted. Why do we focus on SARS-CoV-2 or even SARS, when it emerged at exactly the same time, or better said, it was detected at the same time? And just one point I wanted to make on this. You're talking about cures. Well, that's perfectly correct. That what was found, Sukharit Bhakti recently did a lecture about this, and he explained that when people get the vaccines that are given to them in Britain and Europe, they found that the type of antibodies that appear are antibodies that are recognizing a known virus. So if you've got an unknown virus, the reaction should take about 30 days to take place. But if it's a known virus, then the reaction of the body will be within about 10 days. And they found that it's everyone has a reaction within about 10 days. In other words, the cross-reactivity to all the known common coronaviruses is what is protecting people against these coronaviruses, except the immunocompromised or those who live in fear. And fear is a major component in the cytokine storm that you mentioned earlier on. Now, the other element to all of this, which is this, at the center of the issue that you've just raised, is yes, you should be taking, if you're going to take anything against this, it should be a coronavirus. And how should it be administered? It should be administered orally. In other words, in the nose or the throat, because that's where the coronaviruses enter the body. They don't enter through the muscle in the arm. And so you're training the wrong parts of the body in any case. But the other thing is there are plenty of treatments which have been proven relatively efficacious and which can reduce the amount of death and severe outcomes by about 75%. But they're things that should be taken very early when you come down ill. Like, you know, in the past, you used to get the, you know, a lung infection or something like that, or you've got a bad cold and the doctor used to say, oh, take some chicken soup. Well, you know, take some vitamin D would be one thing, you know, all the usual things. And then there are other treatments you can get. There's an asthma treatment because they found that early on in Wuhan, they found that people who've got asthma were very underrepresented in the people coming down severely ill with SARS-CoV-2. So they looked at why. And then they saw they were taking these inhalers. And these inhalers have subsequently been tested and studied in The Lancet last month or the month before, saying that some of the cortisone, I think it is, inhalers, have about a 95% efficacy rate to prevent severe inflammation of the lungs in the early stages of a SARS-CoV-2 or COVID infection, COVID illness, early stages of an illness. And that's the period when you need to be intervening. Instead of that, what happens in Britain and in Europe is as soon if you're found positive, they just tell you to stay at home. And then when you're on death's door, which you can get within about 10 days or so, then suddenly you're supposed to go to hospital. And in the meantime, they tell you to do nothing. And that's what's causing the problems, is that the method of preventing people going to hospital is not being done. And then you're stoked up, then you sit at home thinking, am I going to die? Am I going to die? Am I going to die? And of course, that exacerbates your illness.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? Cheering for the National Health Service that actually did, you know, impose this protocol of stay at home and cross your fingers, really, rather than be treated. Amazing. I mean, it's what we're looking at here is an absolutely almost unbelievable, you know, misinformation, disinformation. And I suppose the big word is the C word is censorship. You know, really, you know, some of the most, should we say, specialized doctors. I mean, we're talking here about immunologists, virologists, epidemiologists, the various practices in medicine that are supposed to deal with this have simply been censored. So as they start to pick up into the tens and hundreds of thousands of hits on YouTube, as you were saying right at the start, you know, you've got the censorship literally switched off. As soon as it starts to pick up and become like it may turn viral with millions of people watching something, then the you know, the button is pressed. And as a result of all of this, you know, this is against the backdrop of the mass media, which is increasingly close to people like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the United States and, of course, in Europe and here in just actually right next door to my old school where I went to is the Wellcome Trust and what used to be called Burroughs Wellcome. Yeah, which is a computer firm, you know, that produced the first programs for the Mossad to track people around the world in the 1980s. And so there is this high tech kind of industry kind of bringing. But anyway, they seem to have colonized the mass media. And we're in the situation now where next week we've got this absolutely appalling hearing for Julian Assange, who I suppose, you know, right now, many millions of people would consider him probably the most important investigative journalist and or publisher in the world, bar none. You know, he revealed things that were previously just conspiracy theories, you know, maybe with, you know, leaks to journalists, but nothing that they could really go on. Well, Assange published the documents, for example, to show that the National Security Agency and GCHQ are and were using televisions that appeared to be off to listen to people. So this is all very 1984. So what do you think is going to happen to Assange? Is there any chance that the state in the UK might stand up to the United States and release him? Because he doesn't actually appear to have committed any crime whatsoever in Britain.
I can't answer. I mean, my guess will be the state will send him to the States. I mean, my guess will be this is the territory we've entered. And don't forget, for example, linked in with all this anti-China hysteria was this recent decision by the British, the Australians and the Americans to organise that the Australians will push out the French and take nuclear weapons. Was it from nuclear powered submarines, was it from Britain or from America or Britain, one or the other? And there's a multi-billion pound deal stoking up the flames of war for no reason whatsoever. And the type of reasoning that becomes, if you like, the type of background subconscious layer is to stoke up this idea associated with Wuhan Lab and that sort of thing, that the Chinese are going around basically spreading disease around the world and deliberately poisoning people, and you know, some grand conspiracy to destroy the planet as well. And Assange is a victim of the entire global power of the international tech companies who fear. I mean, they do fear, but they've also got enormous power. You know, when YouTube shut down my channel, they took all my videos off, so 15 years of videos, 240 videos, most of which I don't have a copy of, and they delete you from history. At least your record of your material is deleted from history. And then they threatened me. Basically, they said, if you come to our offices again, we will take, you know, further action. Well, what is the further action they can take? And then I checked. And I saw that Google can actually delete you totally from the entire Google network. What does that mean? Well, I've got a Huawei phone. My Huawei phone won't work. What if you've got a Google phone? Your phone will not work. And so they can exclude you like a, you know, like the passports they're trying to talk about for vaccination. They can exclude you from society. And they've certainly done that with us. I mean, you know, when I went to the World Transformed a few weeks ago at the Labour Party conference, and I just tried to get a question in, I was attacked and beaten up in front of Jeremy Corbyn, you know, and this is supposed to be the people. I mean, these are people who say, yes, yeah, support the Extinction Rebellion sitting on the street. But if you stand up and ask a question at a Labour Party, left wing Labour Party meeting, you get physically assaulted. I was punched in the face. I did an interview with the police just this morning about it. Bruises all over my body. And it wasn't just once. It was twice they did this. I went to a second meeting. I went in disguise with a wig on and a mask on, and with alongside peers. We were both wore wigs and masks. We went inside the event. We stood outside in an open air environment in the pouring rain, and we invited people. When their meeting finished, they had a rally. When their rally finished and people were coming out, we said, well, why don't we debate, and we're prepared to forgive you for attacking us the other day. What did they do? Attack us again. And so a psychology has been created, particularly amongst the what I would call the liberal left, who may call themselves far left or whatever, but they're liberal. They're liberal in the sense that they adopt all the agenda of big tech and big pharma around the world, all the agenda on climate, all the agenda on coronavirus, all the agenda on restrictions. They adopt them as some sort of virtue signal that they must support, and that these are somehow, I don't know, communistic or socialistic objectives, you know, look after health, you know, advance the technology to save the planet. And because of that, they also adopt the hysterical approach to dissidents, which is in complete contradiction with what, for example, Rosa Luxemburg said. Freedom is always and only the freedom for those who think differently to you. And the left should stand up and take notice of what she said at that time. And what was said, I'm just printing out posters at the moment. I'll quote you from Karl Marx. He said, under constant medical tutelage, life would be regarded as an evil and the human body as an object for treatment by medical institutions. Is not death more desirable than life, that is a mere preventative measure against death? Does not life involve also free movement? What is an illness except life that is hampered in its freedom? And so, you know, these people simply know nothing about what democracy and freedom is, and they represent a caste, a sort of bureaucratic, often linked into the public sector caste of people who think they know better than everybody else, and it's infiltrated every single institution of modern intellectual thought. So it's infiltrated the study of cosmology. It's infiltrated the study of astrophysics, cosmology. It's infiltrated the study of illnesses and disease. Marx had a very clear view on disease. He thought disease was created by social conditions. He didn't think the agents were responsible for disease, not the general disease that people get. He thought that life expectancy and so on could be extended by improving the living standards of the masses. And that was proven up until the Second World War. As living standards rose, life expectancy rose, and healthcare and health outcomes for people improved, despite the lack of advance in medical treatments at the time, or lack of significant advance in comparison to the numbers of people whose lives were being improved. And so he regarded, like Frederick Engels, the condition of the working classes to be the foundation for their health, not this or that drug or pharmaceutical intervention. And in economics, we've had econometrics and all sorts of lunatics involved from business schools and Harvard and Stanford and God knows what, getting Nobel Prizes for economic projects that destroy the economy. And then we've got the whole climate discussion, where that's a taboo to even ask any questions. And so we have this snuffing out of critical intellectual thinking, starting with the intellectuals. And then they look at the dirty masses, you know, the working classes. They're just considered thick because they might come out with some inappropriate comment every now and again, set by a set of rules about what's allowed to be said.
Keir Starmer and the Trilateral Commission, it's sort of got swept over a little bit, this. He's part of this organization, which was created by the Rockefeller Foundation a few years after the Bilderbergers were created back in the 1950s. They are absolutely unswervingly globalist and anti-democratic. And I wonder if that's influenced the way that Keir Starmer is, steering the left in the UK and the Labour Party, and whether the Labour Party can actually survive this and stand any chance at the next general election. But I suppose because, you know, it seems that for most Labour votes these days will be simply, you know, they won't be a positive thing. There will just be a reaction, quite understandable, against the Tory government.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't define Keir Starmer or the Labour Party as in any way left wing. But then again, I don't really like the term left-wing anyway. I think it's kind of an empty phrase. The problem lies elsewhere, however. Unfortunately, the problem lies inside those who really do identify as left and who call themselves socialists and the Corbynite supporters. Unfortunately, the problem lies there. Because if you're talking about how you can change, you can't change Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer is establishment. He was the establishment candidate. He was establishment saboteur. He returned the Labour Party to the establishment. Jeremy Corbyn was outside the establishment, but he fell for all the liberal promoted by the Democratic Party establishment in the United States of America, or its left wing, as they call it. So from Bernie Sanders to AOC, you know, the old sage and the beautiful star of the new left, they promoted all essentially non-class-based arguments, although they give a nod and a wink to inequality and racism. In reality, their ideas are all based on maintaining capitalism and the status quo. And so our problem really lies in that genre, in that field, I had some discussions, for example, last week with Noam Chomsky. Some communication, he's polite enough at least to reply. And I don't know if you saw that he said the unvaccinated should be isolated from the vaccinated. So they should be effectively put in internment camps or something of that nature. And I took him up on this. And he just kept insisting and insisting. There are people dying. There are people dying. You know, all the usual phrases, knee-jerk phrases from the most ignorant people. He came out with them. You know, what a go to Michigan and see the intensive care unit wards and so on.
Well, maybe something you could do is actually isolate people who've been vaccinated. That would do it for Nome.
Well, I've just been looking at this question. It's a very scary thing. I was just responding to someone this morning, so I did check up on the references to it, the seasonality of coronaviruses. And last year, during the summer, the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 effectively disappeared in Britain. There were a handful of cases, a handful of deaths, and only very few cases, although they began to test quite a lot at that time. And then when the autumn came, there was a revival of a new season, not a second wave. Coronaviruses come in seasons, or they used to. And the really strange thing is that the seasonality of coronaviruses, and I looked at two academic papers on this a few minutes ago, all peer-reviewed in the Journal of Virology and so on. No, the International Journal of Infectious Diseases, sorry. And they show that over long time studies, coronaviruses have an extremely high seasonality. So the question now comes, why has the seasonality, how have we broken? And it must be something about the interventions man has made that has broken the seasonality of this coronavirus, if the figures are true. And that, in my opinion, the only correlating factor is the ubiquitous injection of people with some sort of agent which is supposed to produce the appearance of the coronavirus. And somehow it seems that that's I don't know how, but somehow that's connected together.
Okay, well, look, let's wind up, Heiko, with just a kind of revisiting the press freedom issue and Julian Assange, because, I mean, it is so utterly appalling that somebody like you should have your archives not only deleted for people to look at, but you yourself are denied them. Just to remind listeners that if they go to takeout, which is one word, takeout.google.com, you can there download everything that Google has about you, supposedly. That is including things that you've sent to Google email lists, the Google Usenet, also your Gmail material, and videos that you've uploaded to YouTube. So at least there's something that hopefully that wouldn't necessarily happen in the future.
Yeah, maybe they'd have to give me them, actually. Maybe you're right.
But anyway, look, I just wanted to ask you, as someone that's quite familiar with Speaker's Corner, if Julian Assange was sort of, rescued by helicopter somehow and transported and dropped at Speaker's Corner this weekend before he got arrested, what do you think he'd be saying?
They've tried to drive me insane, and they're going to do and they're doing that to the whole world. I mean, I think that's. And they've tried to physically destroy him and to make people who are, it's all about cowing people, isn't it? How do you scare people? You know, the Ed Snowden, for example, he's not pro-Russian, but he ended up in Russia because it was the safest place for him in the circumstances. Julian Assange, you know, he just wanted to whistleblow, to tell the story, to find out the truth. And the pursuit of truth is a forbidden zone nowadays. Go so far and no further. If you go any further, we'll come for you. And we've got, you know, presumably enough material on most people to try and do them for something. So it does become like scary in the background of your head. You wonder what's going to happen. I ever since the events a couple of weeks ago, you know, from people attacking me who I would assumed were my comrades, you know, were people I'd been working with in one way or another for decades. The fact that entourage or that following now think it's open court to physically assault people who disagree with their views indicates we've entered a very dark period. And I do actually I did underground work in East Germany, and I was taught by one of the underground activists, the leading figures of the opposition there, how to check over your shoulder that no one's following you, you know. And I've started to do that again in walking around the streets of London, you know, just in case someone's about to jump on your back. And that's the type of world we've entered, you know. We've entered a world of genuine, you know, some genuine danger for people who are determined to find out the truth and to expose the truth.
Well, what advice have you got from your experience in Eastern Europe of having to, you know, for people here who feel that they are going to have to go underground because, you know, simply the authorities, rather than protecting them, are even not necessarily persecuting them, but standing aside whilst the banksters, the corporations, the powerful forces in the establishment do persecute them. So, you know, what advice have you got for people who are thinking, well, maybe we do need to go underground?
Yeah, you need to make it as difficult as possible for them, which again is not that easy, you know. Since, like I said, if you've got a Google account, the likelihood is that everything on your is monitored. If you're active in politics already, then probably that's all monitored somewhere already. Doesn't mean they do anything with it immediately. There are certain times when they might decide to pull things out of the hat and attack you with them. And so it's about making it difficult for them. As much possible work as you can should be done external to the internet, should be done in the real world, because that's the unknown factor they can't monitor. They can monitor and if you like, channel internet activities. But what goes on in the real world has a greater degree of spontaneity. Let me give an example. Years back when the Stop the War Coalition began, they used to call meetings which were supposedly democratic. So I'd go along, like I did at the World Transformed, and just get up and try and speak. You know, they'd say, oh, any questions? Say, hands up. And then eventually they have to take you because you stand there, you're the only one standing with your hand up right in front of the stage. And then eventually they have to take you, or else you have to take the platform yourself and say, excuse me. So what I used to say is, well, let's go to Trafalgar Square. Yes. Let's not have a list of speakers of 20 people everyone's heard 1,000 times before. Doesn't mean they can't speak, but let's have 20 platforms and let anyone who get up and speak, including those people who want to speak from the other, and then take votes at the meeting itself as to what you will do, because they can't tell in advance how a crowd will respond to a particular argument or position or vote, whereas they can tell in advance that if you say you're going to go to Trafalgar Square and hold a rally, they know exactly what they're dealing with. But unless you are then going to decide what you do there and then. So the spontaneity of real human communication undermines them more than anything else. And yes, then you can multiply that through, you know, underground channels, Telegram, Signal, whatever. I'm only starting to get familiar with those things at the moment.
The idea that these social media and Telegram channels is where it's really at, I think, is, for the birds. Anyway, Heiko, how do people find you online and follow your work now? You've had your, Eric Schmidt has pressed the nuclear button on your YouTube channel.
I run the Karl Marx walking tour, so I do that. If you want a theoretical foundation for what I do, it's Marxism and the Karl Marx walking tour. I'd run every Sunday at 11 o'clock from Piccadilly Circus, marxwalks.com, and speakerscorner.net is the website. It was a generic website for Speakers Corner. I haven't really updated it for a long time, but that's to have a look around Speakers Corner, the historical stuff. You can catch me at Speakers Corner at about 2:30 in the afternoon, nearly every Sunday. So that's, again, a physical live meeting. And if you want to email me, it's heikokoo, heikokhoo at gmail.com. It shouldn't be Gmail, but it is.
Okay. So that, just to remind listeners, it's takeout.google.com if you want to get download the information that they have on you before they delete you. Heiko Koo, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.